Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's prison population has risen drastically since the 1990s, and the state's prisons are nearing capacity. We'll talk to a state lawmaker about his bills that aim to fix that problem.
First, since the mid-1990s, 17-year-olds in Wisconsin who commit a crime and are arrested are tried as adults in the state's court system. Lawmakers at the time saw this as a way to prevent young people from committing a crime.
Our next guest says the law hasn't worked out that way and that trying 17-year-olds as adults might not keep them from reoffending in the future.
State Senator Jerry Petruski joins us now. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 29th Senate District, which includes Marathon. He's introduced legislation that would allow 17-year-olds to be charged as juveniles for their first-time nonviolent offense. Senator Petruski, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
So, Senator Petruski, what's in this bill that you're proposing?
Well, it has a variety of names. 17-year-old juvenile bill, some call it the second chance bill. What the bill really does is it takes those first-time nonviolent offenders and keeps them in the juvenile court rather than going and getting shifted into the adult court.
And what prompted you to draft this legislation?
Well, I had a number of friends that were working on this through the years, and my hope is that we can finally get it done because there are a lot of positives to this bill.
And what do you see as the positives that could come out of this if it ultimately does pass?
Well, from all the studies I have seen, that if you keep these 17-year-old juveniles, again, first-time nonviolent offenders, that they have a less likely chance of reoffending. Some studies show 34%, some show as high as 50%. But it will keep the juveniles in the juvenile operation. It will give them the help and the counseling and the guidance that they need. Unfortunately, everything is about dollars, but if we can keep people out of the corrections, that's a long-term saving for the state, long-term for all of us. Plus, I think the most important thing is everybody probably makes mistakes in their lives, and once somebody is in the system, they're on CCAP, they have a hard time staying in school. They have a hard time getting accepted into college. They have a hard time getting into the military. They have a hard time finding a place to live, to rent. They have a hard time of getting a job. So this is really a problem for kids that sometimes do something stupid. And I think our goal should be to get them back on the right path and get them back into being valuable members of society.
So you represent the 29th Senate District, which does include Marathon. What have you seen, in your community with the impact of the Wisconsin law as it currently stands?
Well, this law has been in place since 1996, and a lot of the offenders really are young, and they did something stupid. I can understand if somebody did, a violent crime, but a lot of times this is just something stupid that kids have done, and they end up getting into the system, and, they have a hard time getting back out of that. And so if we can keep them from being swallowed up by the court system and corrections, I think they have a much better chance at life and of being a valuable member of society.
And so what kind of crimes do you see falling under the rubric of nonviolent in this legislation?
Well, sometimes somebody will maybe not pay fines. Sometimes they will do some minor damage, whether it's throwing a rock or whatever. Sometimes they're part of a group that does something wrong. The problem is that we need to keep them out of the criminal element, but we need to go ahead and get them back where they have, efforts are made to rehab, to make sure that they're going to school. They can mandate, attendance at school. They can keep parents involved in the life of the young person and, some responsibility within the family. Sometimes they have situations where they have a family that is not normally functional, but we can take steps to try to correct that. And I think it's just a good bill. We have run into trouble before with having enough money because everything takes money and it's going to be in the juvenile system. This bill, this time around, we're putting in an extra $5 million per year to make sure that the county has enough money to function with this. So I'm optimistic about getting it done this time.
We're talking to State Senator Jerry Petrusky right now. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 29th Senate District. That includes Marathon. And he has reintroduced some legislation that would allow 17-year-olds charged with their first-time nonviolent offense to be charged as minors. And this is not the first time that you have introduced legislation like this. It's had some difficulty passing in the past. Why do you see, and you kind of mentioned cost being an issue, but have there been other problems with getting this going in the past?
No, the biggest problem we ran into is the fear that the counties are not going to have the money to do it. And, you know, of course, they're under revenue limits. Their costs are continuing to go up. We've had a number of discussions on how we do this. We'll do it through Children and Families to determine which charges are, you know, the costs are legitimate. But I think this time we're putting in $5 million a year, but also with the ability to go beyond that if there are some unforeseen costs that can be justified.
There are some logistical issues that come with potentially changing the system as it is now. Do you see that being a simple change, or do you think that there could be some hiccups along the way if this passes?
No, I think it's really a simple bill because it comes down to first-time nonviolent offenders, and if we keep them in the juvenile system, of course, you know, the people are in place to handle that. I just think this bill, even though we're going to have to put some more money into the county, I think overall the state will come out better because we'll be keeping people out of the system. I think it's just a win all the way around.
And what have you heard from your colleagues on this bill?
Well, certainly has always been support for it. The money issue was really the roadblock that we were struggling with. And the last session, we pretty well had a deal, and all of a sudden something didn't go right. So we're approaching this with some optimism. We made some changes to the reimbursement route. And I don't know, like I say, I'm optimistic, and I think this time hopefully we will get this done.
And so even logistically, what's the timeline for even voting on this legislation?
Well, as you know, session probably will end in February or March or maybe even April. We don't really know. So, you know, we're running out of time in a hurry. But I think there is support. Last time we had a lot of co-sponsors. I didn't bother to count them this time. But I think that we could get to the finish line with this and get it to the governor's desk so he could sign it.
Well, Senator Petrusky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jay.
Senator Jerry Petrusky is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 29th Senate District. He joined us today to talk about new legislation he's introduced that would allow 17-year-olds in the state to be tried as juveniles when they commit their first-time nonviolent offense. Currently, the law tries them as adults.
Wisconsin's prison population has more than tripled since 1990, and that's put a strain on detention facilities. If current trends continue, new prisoners may have to be sent to other states as soon as next year.
Three proposed bills in the state capitol look to address that problem. They would change rules about sending people back to prison for certain parole violations, expand the state's earned release program, and repurpose the troubled Lincoln Hills Youth Prison.
Representative Evan Goyke is a Democrat from the state's 18th Assembly District in Milwaukee. He's the author of the legislation, and he's with us now in the studio. Representative Goyke, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
You did a presentation about this, talking about prisoner number 501. What do you mean by that?
So inmate 501 is a real person. It stands, though, for the one prisoner too many of the total capacity that we have in our prisons and jails. So our prisons are built to hold about 16,000 people. Tonight they hold a little over 23,000 people, and we have about 450 that spill over from the prisons into county jails, but there's only 500 total spots. So 501, and we're almost to 501, will have to go somewhere else and possibly or likely out of state.
Why did we get here? We went from about 7,000 prisoners in about 1990 up to, as you say, 23,000.
So it's a combination, and I want to confess that this has been a bipartisan problem. Both parties have been responsible for legislation that have increased the prison populations. You know, when I was a kid, we were engaged in the war on drugs, and we believed that incarcerating people would deter crime. That can happen, but it really hasn't led to the promises that we were told it would. And so we've created laws that have increased criminal penalties on a variety of bad behaviors, and so people are going to prison today at a higher rate. And then lastly, our prison system is non-discretionary. So if somebody gets a two-year sentence, they must serve all two of those years. There's no ability for the Department of Corrections to let them out early.
Before we get to the particulars, you mentioned this is a bipartisan problem. Are you starting to see a sense of bipartisan solutions? You presented this Prisoner 501 to a bipartisan group of lawmakers and their aides.
I do. I do see this as a bipartisan issue that we have to solve. States, I look around the country, and states around the country are solving prison population crises through meaningful criminal justice reform in places that would surprise you. Republicans in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, Democrats on the coasts, and largely they're arriving at the same policy solutions, and those bills are advancing with Democratic and Republican support. I think we're getting close to that point here in Wisconsin because we're coming close to that crisis of sending people out of state or engaging in a discussion about building a new prison.
And that price tag seems like a motivator in even tough on crime states around the country. Can you talk about the impact of the two solutions you mentioned, building more prisons or sending more prisoners maybe to private facilities out of state?
So tonight, today, the state of Wisconsin will spend about $23,000 to house inmates in county jails. That rate would increase, dozens of thousands of dollars every single day if we have to ship people out of state, because the out-of-state rate is more than housing them in-state. The Department of Corrections has estimated a new prison would cost upwards of $300 million. And so these are financial decisions that are totally avoidable through some common sense and fairly easy criminal justice reforms that we've proposed that other states, conservative states and liberal states, have engaged in.
Assembly Representative Evan Goyke is with us, a Democrat from Milwaukee, talking about a package of prison reform bills he's working on. And let's get into some of those now. Representative Goyke, one of your bills deals with revocation, meaning when someone's out of jail, they're on parole, they get sent back. What do you want to see changed there?
So the bill would say that the Department of Corrections can incarcerate for shorter periods of time when people on parole or probation violate the rules but don't commit a new crime. So we're talking about missing meetings, or if they have an addiction issue and they test positive for drug use, the bill prioritizes sending those individuals into treatment or potentially short-term incarceration, but not back to prison. It maintains the power of the Department of Corrections to send individuals back to prison if they commit a new crime. But if it's something less serious, the reaction should be something less serious also.
How big a difference would that make?
My estimation is a couple of hundred inmates a year. This is not targeted again at the majority of the prison inmates, but it's a simple solution. Just don't send people back to prison unless they commit crimes. I think it's kind of common sense. It's a fair solution, and it would prevent the prison population from continuing to grow.
I guess the thinking is, okay, you've just gotten out of prison. We've got stricter rules for you. If you can't follow those rules, even if they don't rise to the level of committing a crime today, if you can't follow these rules we've set for you, maybe you're at risk of reoffending anyway.
That would certainly be the kind of argument behind the law that we currently have. The problem is there's social science that proves that sending somebody back to prison for a year or more for a non-criminal violation is an overreaction. It doesn't actually address the bad behavior in a meaningful way. Something shorter but still serious, like a 30 days in jail, is a more appropriate response.
Let's move on to another one of your proposals now. The ability to have a sentence reduced, time off for good behavior, is the phrase. I don't know if that's the official legal phrase in Wisconsin, but that's the concept. We as I understand it, don't have that anymore. You can't earn time off of prison with good behavior.
There are only a handful or percentage of inmates that can get out of prison early, and it's called the Earned Release Program, and it is only for inmates that have an alcohol or other drug addiction, and it's after they successfully complete that treatment to address that addiction issue. So our bill expands the number of eligible inmates and expands the number of eligible programs. So if somebody is in prison and they don't have an addiction issue, but they also don't have a high school diploma, we treat completing their high school education like completing alcohol or other drug treatment. So obtaining your GED, doing something useful that will reduce your likelihood of reoffending when you get out of prison, we would reduce their prison term by a certain amount, but we add that amount to the end of their community supervision. So say an inmate has their prison sentence reduced by 3 months, they would be on parole for 3 additional months. So we still are watching them for the same amount of time.
Is this something that you've seen happen in other states and get bipartisan support?
Yes, this is something that's been done in other states. And again, it's building off of an existing program that we have in the state of Wisconsin.
This is something that people, when elections aren't happening, might work together on. It's an easy campaign ad. If somebody commits a crime, they've been subject to some kind of early release, the ad writes itself if one party in the election supported that and not the other. This is something that blows up really easy.
Yeah, I appreciate the heads up to all my political opponents out there, helping them come up with a campaign against me. It is a challenging issue to solve. Crime and punishment, and when I've been a victim of crime, my family's been a victim of crime, it is really very difficult to roll our sleeves up and solve these issues. But these solutions are not simply lighter on crime or allowing people to get away with bad behavior. It's tailoring our response to have the best outcome. These solutions can actually reduce crime. Focus our resources, like incarceration, on people that are violent, and don't overreact and send people back to prison for non-criminal behavior.
And how... for the early release, the earned release program, expanding that a little bit, how big a difference is that going to make in terms of prison overcrowding?
We think that bill has the potential to really ease this conversation about sending people out of state or building a new prison. We're talking about expanding this to several hundred, potentially thousands of additional inmates. And again, it's not wiping their sentence in half, but even these small reductions of 3 months or 6 months would make a huge difference to the prison population.
And then finally, you've got kind of a two-part plan for the troubled Lincoln Hills Youth Corrections Facility. We've been hearing headlines about this for years now. The problems going on there, hazardous for inmates and staff there. What are you looking to do?
So Lincoln Hills in our juvenile prison system has the opposite problem that we've just been talking about in the adult system. The population of Lincoln Hills has been falling. So tonight, that facility is about 70% vacant, meaning the use of that facility is not very efficient. And so our bill would adopt smaller, regionalized, and need-based facilities so that the juveniles are housed closer to the communities and families they come from. And using the facility of Lincoln Hills, which is built like a minimum security prison, we would use those space to, one, prevent sending people out of state or building a new prison. And the facility itself is built in a way that I think it could be used as a treatment facility very quickly.
That idea of moving the current residents at Lincoln Hills to smaller, regional, closer to home facilities, a lot of people are talking about this. It's not a quick and easy solution, maybe not a cheap solution.
That's absolutely correct. There are capital costs in developing these smaller institutions around the state and staffing them. But one thing I would point out is that the legislature this year in the state budget increased the cost of housing a juvenile at Lincoln Hills to $390 per day. So it's just under $150,000 per year for a juvenile inmate at Lincoln Hills. And the counties in Wisconsin bear that cost. Counties did not get increased money for this increased payment, and they're going to find these alternatives. They're going to create them locally, and our population at Lincoln Hills is only going to continue to decrease. So we've got to come up with a better use for that facility.
Those are the solutions you're offering. I want to get back to the problem side a little bit. In addition to the idea of, well, do we need new prisons? Do we need to send inmates out of state? What are the current concerns? You said we're over capacity in the prisons we have right now. What are the concerns when it comes to staff and inmate safety?
So if a cell is built for one person, but there are two people in it, that is a much less safe scenario.
And this is happening.
This is happening all over the state of Wisconsin. And in some facilities, a third inmate is sleeping on an inflatable mattress on the ground. To all the listeners, this is just common sense. Two people in a tight space is more dangerous than just one. And for guards, that means, you know, covering more people. It has also meant more people with acute mental health illnesses housed with other inmates in close quarters, and it leads to more disruption and less safety in the facility for both inmates and the guards.
You've referred a couple times to mental health and addiction issues. I don't think they're part of your current legislation here, but is that part of the puzzle here, trying to refer people to treatment instead of incarceration?
It is, and I will confess that it is part of the broader solution, but not part of the three bills. My goal with these three bills is to stop from building a new prison or stop from sending guys out of state in the short term. Our prison system has become one of the state's largest providers of mental health services. And it is an absolute tragedy. I was a lawyer in the criminal justice system as a public defender in Milwaukee prior to being elected, and I represented people suffering from mental illness day after day. And our system is not built to accommodate these people appropriately, and so we warehouse them in prison, and they do not get the treatment that they need. And so what happens is they continue to commit crimes, and we don't solve the root causes.
Briefly, what's your timeline on trying to get these three pieces of legislation passed?
Well, the problem's here. It's immediate. I think we're going to be sending people out of state very soon. So I'm hoping to get hearings in the legislature. We've just wrapped up our co-sponsorship period. There is bipartisan support in each of these bills. So my next step is working with legislative leadership to hold public hearings, to get estimates from the Department of Corrections on how much they would cost or save, and then move forward.
Representative Goyke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Representative Evan Goyke, Democrat from the state's 18th Assembly District in Milwaukee, talking about his prison reform legislation.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at what challenges young farmers face and what resources are available here in Wisconsin. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Going into the farm business can be difficult. There are challenges that many young people share, like paying off student loans, but there are also issues that are unique to farming, getting access to farmland and figuring out things like healthcare coverage and how to make a living right away.
The National Young Farmers Coalition recently gathered data from over 3,500 farmers under the age of 40. They wanted to look at what barriers there are for young people and what policies and practices can help them overcome these barriers.
And this could be a critical issue for the future of farming. Farmers over the age of 65 outnumber farmers under 35 by a margin of 6-1, and nearly two-thirds of U.S. farmland is set to transition to new ownership within the next 20 years. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a young farmer? Are you just trying to get into the business of farming? What worries you and what's drawing you in? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Sophie Ackoff is with the National Young Farmers Coalition. She's their national field director. Sophie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
And Kathy Schmidt is the director of the Wisconsin Farm Center, which is part of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Kathy, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
So, Sophie, let's start with you. Let's look at this survey. What were you hoping to learn by conducting this?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a really important time to ask young farmers what their needs are. The Farm Bill is up for reauthorization. It's set to expire next September, and we did this survey because we needed to know the most pressing challenges facing this generation of young farmers so that we could then turn to Congress and ask for their support in the next Farm Bill. So we went into it, you know, just wanting to learn more and find out, you know, what are the top challenges you face? You know, how are you running your farm businesses so that we could take that to D.C. And make policy supportive of young farmers?
And how did you find these 3,500 people that you surveyed for this?
Yeah, so we have a large network ourselves, and then we partnered with 94 partner organizations across the country so that we could really get to young farmers in every state and doing, you know, all kinds of agriculture. So we really reached out to partner organizations to share the survey with their networks so that we could get as large a sample as possible.
And what did you learn about these 3,500 young farmers?
Yeah, well, we learned that land access is the number one challenge. And it's the number one challenge for young farmers who quit farming, the reason why they stop farming. It's the number one thing that aspiring farmers talk about as a challenge to getting started. And also for current farmers, both from multi-generational farm families and farmers who are the first generation to farm, land access is the number one challenge that they face.
So, Kathy, Sophie just said that one of the biggest challenges facing young farmers is land access. We are an agricultural state. Are you hearing similar things from farmers here in Wisconsin?
Definitely. Land access is a problem, and affordable land primarily, I think, especially for those farming endeavors where it's more likely to generate enough income to support that family or at least that individual wholly. Indeed it is.
And going back to you, Sophie, one of the other big things facing younger farmers right now is student loan debt. Student loan debt is some of the highest it has ever been. You know, how do young farmers who want to farm, it's not the most lucrative field, how do they reconcile that debt with going into a field that isn't really a moneymaker?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, farming is capital intensive and it's risky. And accessing credit to farm is already difficult. So when you're, you know, saddled with thousands of dollars of student loan debt, like many young people today, you're often denied loans to grow your farm business or to get started at all. And actually, right now, the Higher Education Act is in markup in Congress, and we are offering. We're working with Representative Courtney to offer an amendment to add farmers to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which would really help young farmers manage their student loan debt by making income-based payments for 10 years and then seeing the rest of those payments forgiven. So we've been working on this outside of the Farm Bill, but it is an agricultural issue. We need young people to succeed and start farm businesses and grow these businesses to feed our country. So it's really important that the government stand up and support these young people by helping manage their student loans.
And Kathy, just following up on that, are we seeing something similar here in Wisconsin that maybe this is a barrier for young people to maybe stay in the state?
We are, and actually there was a bill that was proposed to do something about student loan debt in this last legislative session. So I'm not sure where that's at presently, but certainly it is something that people are aware of.
And now we are talking to Kathy Schmidt right now. She is the director of the Wisconsin Farm Center. That's part of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And we're also joined by Sophie Ackoff. She is the national field director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. And we are talking about barriers to entry for many young farmers who might want to become farmers and stay in the field. Now, Sophie, how are young farmers different from earlier generations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we asked a lot of questions around how young farmers are, you know, building their businesses. And we found that young farmers are really capitalizing on the good food movement and are selling direct to consumer and really capturing, you know, a larger portion of the food dollar. So we found that these farmers are, you know, growing diversified farms and selling at farmers markets and through community-supported agriculture programs. We also had 60% of our survey respondents were women, which is very exciting and, you know, something different than we've seen in generations past. Another really important factor is that 75% of our survey respondents did not grow up on a farm. So these are young people who are, you know, coming from the cities and the suburbs, who are really excited to change the food system and do something concrete for their communities, and they're coming to agriculture. And they have a unique set of challenges. They're not inheriting land from their parents. They don't know how USDA works. They have student loans. So it's really important that we look at the unique features of this generation and how we then create policies to support them.
Well, and as farming moves, you know, into the future, you wouldn't want that to be necessarily a deterrent for these first generation farmers. You would want maybe to encourage them a little bit more, because it's not as though maybe second generation farmers or fifth generation farmers are necessarily staying in farming.
Right, exactly. You know, we saw from the 1980s farm crisis, the farmers were having a hard time, and they were telling their children that there wasn't a lot of money to be had in agriculture, and that's why we're at the point where we are, where, you know, only 6% of farmers are under the age of 35, and we hope that by supporting these young people who are getting started in agriculture and returning to the farm, by helping them achieve success, that other young people will join them and they'll, you know, learn by example and see that it is possible to support your family through farming. And then, you know, hopefully we will, you know, have their children grow up to be farmers.
Now, Kathy, we've heard some sort of larger statistics. More women are getting into farming. I know that in the report as well, it looks as though the racial makeup is getting significantly more diverse. Is that something that we're seeing here in Wisconsin?
Oh, we definitely are. There are somewhere around 9,000 women who are principal operators, meaning they have a decision-making piece to their farm operation. They're not just a small part of that farming operation. So we're definitely seeing that. And we have a very strong minority population in farming, specifically with Hmong people and the fresh vegetable markets. So we're seeing that diversification as well. And there are groups that do need some assistance in connecting with the government resources that are there, and with, you know, learning about some of the risk management techniques and the financial management things that help to make the farm successful.
Right now, we are talking about obstacles that many young farmers face as they become farmers and what resources might be available to help them succeed. Our guests right now are Kathy Schmidt. She is the director of the Wisconsin Farm Center, which is part of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And we're also joined by Sophie Ackoff. She is the national field director for the National Young Farmers Coalition.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you in your 20s or maybe 30s hoping to farm? What are the biggest obstacles you're facing? If you're an established farmer, do you think it's harder now to get into farming than it was for your generation? If you have been in farming for a while, do you have a succession plan? Do you know who's going to take over your farmland when you are done farming? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation looking at the barriers facing young people who are trying to get into farming and how those barriers can be addressed. Sophie Ackoff is with us from the National Young Farmers Coalition, and Kathy Schmidt is the director of the Wisconsin Farm Center.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you trying to get into farming? You maybe grew up on a farm, or maybe you didn't. What kind of challenges are there? What obstacles are there? What kind of help would you need? Have you successfully done this? Love to hear your story, too. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
Now, Kathy, you are the director of the Wisconsin Farm Center. What kind of services do you offer farmers in state?
Well, a variety. Everything from financial consultation to succession planning to even counseling vouchers. There's a variety of services that we offer, trying to help farmers with their sustainability and helping them to thrive. We have some minority farmer services, staff that work with specialty crops and organics and grazing, all good options for beginning farmers to take a look at. Just a whole host of services that we provide.
So there are a lot of services that people can take advantage of. So do you find that people do take advantage of them, or for maybe some of these first-generation farmers, they just aren't aware that they're out there?
Awareness is always a problem, and so we're always trying to do some outreach to farm groups and in the newspapers and so on. Our best method is to actually do presentations, and our farm succession presentations have been probably the most popular over the last couple of years. In addition to that, we have an 800 helpline so that people can call in anywhere around the state and ask for information. If we don't know it, we'll help to make that connection and get people going in the direction they need to. We also make farm calls, sit down at the kitchen table with the farm family, helping them work through whatever situation they might have. When it comes to succession planning, meeting with both generations and hearing each generation's goals and concerns, and trying to help them find their way to a succession plan that works for everyone.
We're going to go to our callers right now. We have Deb in Amherst. Hi, Deb.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
And what did you have to say?
Well, I'm a state membership director for Wisconsin Farmers Union, so these types of discussions are near and dear to our hearts as an organization. And we've really seen a lot of the newer, younger farmers popping up all over the state. And all of the things that you brought up are super important as far as financially, you know, land access, things like that. But one of the things that we've really found is something that young farmers are looking for and need to succeed is that feeling of community and having a group that they can work with and be able to depend on. The agricultural industry has kind of gotten away from that a little bit. I grew up on a farm in western Minnesota, and, you know, every neighbor knew everybody else, and you pitched in and helped everybody out. And now it seems like we've gotten away from that, or everybody's kind of out for themselves.
Well, Deb, thank you so much for that call. And so, Sophie, I want to throw this one to you. What are your thoughts on maybe feeling a little disconnected from your community as a young farmer right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we hear that from our farmers every day, and that's really why we've decided to organize in a chapter structure. So we have 40 chapters across the country in 28 states that are really rebuilding that community for young people who are getting into agriculture and bringing farmers together for that peer-to-peer networking to tackle some local challenges through communication and collaboration, and then also to create a voice, a collective voice for making change on the local, state, and national level.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Deb. We're going to go right now to Tom in Southwest Wisconsin. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
And what do you have to say? Yes, we can hear you.
First-time caller. I'm a little bit nervous. But
no, you're good.
I'm a 48-year-old dairy farmer. My wife and I have farmed all our lives. I was able to buy cows from my father and buy a farm when I was 28 to start farming on my own. My wife and I have 6 children, and now my sons would like to get into farming. The biggest obstacle is land prices. I understand it's a two-edged sword because the increase in land value has given me a better balance sheet, but it is very tough for the young fellas, 20s, early 20s, to get a foothold in farming when land prices are so high.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for that call. So there are two things here. One, we're hearing a little bit of an older farmer who is kind of talking about succession there, that his kids would like to maybe farm, and it might be the barrier to entry there might not might be too high. This is a two-parter. So, Kathy, really quickly, can you talk about how maybe he can handle succession there? And then, Sophie, I guess my question then to you in a minute will be getting right back to land prices. It sounds like it's still something that's really affecting a lot of people. So, Kathy, your thoughts.
Sure. As Tom knows, dairy farming is extremely capital intensive, and it is very difficult to bring on a next generation. Where we're seeing some success in that is in families that develop LLCs, and then the children can purchase shares in until they can build enough equity to, you know, make that next step. That still doesn't erase the problem of the land prices, but it does make it for more affordable entry for the younger generation.
And Sophie, what can governments or communities do to make that land access issue less of an issue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what we're working on is really partnering with the conservation community. You know, land trusts are really key partners. They're protecting farmland from development, but they also have a role in protecting the affordability of farmland by putting conservation easements on the land that say the land can't be sold to a working farmer, which really decreases the value of that land and puts it more into the realm of what a working farmer can afford. So at the national level, for the Farm Bill, we're advocating for more government funding to support these conservation easements that really ensure that land is protected for working farmers and affordable into the future.
And this is a question from Facebook. Laura asks, can you talk about the willingness of senior farmers to sell the farm to their children or bring them in? Or are senior farmers hanging on to farms longer? Are you guys seeing that?
We're seeing a little bit of everything. There are definitely farmers that are, the day they leave the farm is the day that they pass away. That is definitely true. But we are also seeing an increased interest in people wanting to make a plan. And, you know, essentially we tell them, if you're not going to make the plan, somebody else is going to do it for you. How do you want to see your farm live on past you? So, yes, there are senior farmers interested. I know we have several that contact us looking for the next generation farmer. But, again, it's putting that package together that is so hard for them to do.
Now, Sophie, when you helped conduct this survey, there were another couple of barriers that the respondents talked about, one being labor and the other being health insurance. At a policy level, how do you see labor and health insurance being something that can be course corrected?
Yes. Well, I'll start with health insurance. Farming's a dangerous, physically strenuous occupation, and the Affordable Care Act has really made it possible for this generation of young people to pursue farming and, have that access to affordable health insurance. And so we are advocating, of course, for the Affordable Care Act to continue and to ensure that there is access to affordable health care into the future. With labor, this is, you know, less of a farm bill opportunity, but immigration reform, you know, we need farm workers in this country to have access to citizenship so they can stay here and they can farm. A lot of the challenge with labor is, access to skilled laborers, and with immigration being as it is now, we're seeing fewer of those skilled farm workers entering the country.
And Kathy, really quickly, we only have about 30 seconds left. What would you like to see happen in the next maybe generation with farming in Wisconsin?
I hope that a lot of the young people continue to try different things to get into farming, and definitely the local food movement has helped to provide a place for that. We still have a lot of small farms in Wisconsin, and they're ideal for a lot of people to begin farming, to test the waters and to make mistakes on a smaller scale.
And Kathy, thank you so much for being with us today. And Sophie, thank you as well. Sophie Ackoff is the National Field Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition, and Kathy Schmidt is Director for the Wisconsin Farm Center, which is part of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We're talking about the challenges facing young farmers.
Now come the days of the king.
May they be blessed.
A triumphant moment there from The Return of the King, the third movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Now, I've seen that scene in that movie twice now, I think once in the theater, once on DVD.
And once or twice is really nothing. We now know that a Canadian viewer has streamed that movie 361 times this year alone, and that's according to new data released by Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix released a bunch of end-of-year binge-watching records. They also tweeted, quote, to the 53 people who have watched A Christmas Prince every day for the past 18 days, who hurt you?
Yeah, that's pretty cutting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a yes, that's a lot of times to watch a movie again and again. There are movies I've rewatched.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
But 300 plus times in 1 year,
I want to say that there's something really impressive about especially that movie because it's so long, but it also makes you might take a pause to say, ooh. Who's watching me watch this?
Exactly. A lot of people have been a little creepified by Netflix. Like, wow, they're really tracking what we watch, and they're sort of making fun of us, not by name. So,
but you know that there's some
that,
people
guys.
Sitting there like, ooh, that was me.
Yeah. It wasn't me, though.
It wasn't me either.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.